from WXXI News. This is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We'll start our week in review with an issue that has dominated conversations in Monroe County over the past week. Advocates for early intervention childhood services say there's a crisis brewing in western New York. Monroe County Executive Cheryl Donolfo agrees. Well, here's what's happening. A number of early intervention service providers in our area have closed their doors in recent months due to a lack of resources. They say they need more service coordinators to help connect families to providers, but there isn't enough funding to pay for them. That means children who need special education, speech or physical therapy, or other services will be put on wait lists. Donolfo says the state needs to step up its reimbursement rates for coordinators and providers, but advocates say the county needs to do more.
What everyone can agree on is that early intervention services are invaluable in the development of children who need them. In this clip, you'll hear from Brittany Jensik, a parent of 21 children, many of whom have received early intervention services. She says her son would not be alive if not for his therapist, Janet Rosenberg. You'll hear from her as well. Here's Brittany.
I have several kiddos who have had early intervention. They were nonverbal, not talking, not walking, had severe sensory issues, diagnosed on the autism spectrum. These kiddos will now, they are now 11 and 16. They go to school, they are in gen ed, they will go to college, they will drive, they will marry, they will be very participating, active members of society giving back. For these kiddos, it made the difference between them potentially costing tax dollars to support them for the rest of their lives and being able to kind of flip that and be, you know, productive members of our society. For the little guy that I brought to the meeting the other night, we started services for him immediately upon bringing him home. Janet, is my son's PT, one day happens to realize that he's slightly hyper-reflexive. So he's kind of high tone, his muscles are tighter than they should be, he's reacting differently than he should. And she brings it to my attention. I kind of say, well, I don't know what that means. And she said, well, it can mean a lot of different things, but I think you should check it out. Well, you know, to kind of make a slightly more complicated story a little shorter, we checked it out and he was in emergency brain surgery having a shunt placed the next day. He was hydrocephalic. He was having pressure buildup in his brain. He needed a shunt placed, and the shunt saved his life. And truly, Janet saved his life. I mean, had I not had the support of people surrounding me, letting me know what was typical, what was out of the ordinary, giving me information, being resources for me, for the family, for my child, he would not be here today. He would not be alive.
I want to ask Janet Rosenberg what you think about that issue of quick intervention when it's needed as opposed to waiting weeks or months.
So we know research shows that, like I said before, intervening early is crucial and critical because birth to three, the brain produces more than a million neural connections each second. And during the first 3 years of life, a child's brain triples in weight and establishes about 1,000 trillion nerve connections. So early is the time. It's when it's most important. And I can think of a number of children that I've worked with over the years that maybe came home from the NICU, had very complicated births, and had a variety of different medical needs. I can think of children that had a diagnosis such as Down syndrome. I can think of children that just were not meeting their milestones. They weren't rolling or they weren't sitting. And the thing to remember is that movement is what leads all aspects of development. If your child is not moving, they're not going to explore. If they're not exploring, they're not going to expand on their skills for learning and cognition. If they're not moving and they have decreased strength, it can impact their ability to produce language and speech. So it's very, very important to be targeting our children at that young age because it does affect all other aspects of development.
Next, Saturday is World AIDS Day, and we had a conversation on the program about advancements in HIV/AIDS research and treatment. One of our guests, Ernest Wilson, joined us to share his powerful personal story. He's HIV positive, he's a patient at Trillium Health, and a founding member of Trillium's Positive Warrior Support Group for HIV positive men.
Wilson says when he was diagnosed in the 1980s, the disease was still considered a death sentence. His doctor told him he had 6 to 12 months to live, and he should get his affairs in order. Now in his 60s, Wilson is speaking out about the disease to help reduce the stigma against it. Here he is, sharing his story.
I'm a 34-year survivor of HIV. I've been living with it, functioning. I found out in 1984 when it was a death sentence back then. I was getting ready to go into the Army, and they gave me 6 months to a year to live after they told me.
Where were you living at the time?
Here in Rochester.
Here in Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember about how you were feeling, or you know, what led up to the actual exam?
Well, like I said, I was getting ready to swear in and go into the Navy.
Did you suspect that you had?
I had no idea.
You had no idea?
No idea.
So do you remember the day that you were told?
Yeah, I celebrate it every year. It's my second birthday. It's actually June 24th.
June 24th. Mm-hmm. What was your reaction, and what do you remember thinking?
I'm going to die, because everybody that I've known that have gotten it, you know, they went to New York, came back, and 6 months later, they were gone. And I just knew after the naval doctor told me that, well, you get six months to a year, and I want you to get your things in order. And that was just devastating for me, because I was going into the Navy to do something for my mom. 3-year contract, see the world, come back, get the GI Bill, get her home. And that just went out the window.
1984.
Yes.
What did you do with this information then?
Denial for years.
Who did you tell?
Nobody. I couldn't tell my mom, because she didn't have no idea what it was about. But over the years, she came to understand what was going on. But I didn't tell anybody for a while. I stopped dating, just worked, and came home.
You were willing to maybe die within 6 months and not let anyone know you had HIV because of the shame of it, or the
stigma? Yes.
The stigma?
Yes, yes. You know, some of the things that I've been hearing, people not wanting to eat off the plates, throwing plates away, not wanting to touch you or you touch them, not wanting to be around you. I was actually working for a credit union, and I was actually their first HIV positive person. And just the reaction that I was getting from some of the employees. Before, they were all hugs and kisses and whatnot, but then when they found out that I was positive, it changed totally.
Was there a point where you decided, I'm going to start telling people I am going to do that now?
I actually didn't start doing that until probably 4 years ago. I did a campaign.
4 years ago?
4 years
30
ago.
Years after your diagnosis?
Yeah, I mean, wow. I told certain people, but I did a campaign called HIV Stops With Me. And my posters were up everywhere around the city. And at that point, I felt like if, you know, we wasn't in a relationship, you're not paying my rent, you're not paying, putting food on my table, I could care less, you know, what people were going to say about
me. No, I'm with you on that. But over the years, I mean, I'm sure it sounds like you decided to at least tell some family?
Some family members, yes.
What was the reaction like?
Actually, my older sister had passed from HIV, and her reaction, she was very not well educated on it, so she died before I did. But my family members, my older brother, like I said, my mom, she learned about it, you know, as time went on. But as far as close friends, really didn't say nothing, no.
Were you worried that if you did, they would not come around anymore?
Yeah. Yes.
How do you feel on a day-to-day basis? How are you doing these days?
I'm worried more about my old age than HIV. I mean, HIV is it's not even really in my mind anymore. I mean, even though I take a pill every day, but that's the least of my worries. I mean, I feel good every day. I'm out making a difference in the community. You know, I was just awarded the New York State Commissioner's Award this year, which I'll be in Albany on the 4th to receive that.
Congratulations on that.
Exciting.
I always, I made some difference in some people who had newly diagnosed, made a difference in their life, and I feel good about that.
Next, a conversation about hair, politics, and Black identity. A documentary called Back to Natural explores how natural African-American hair is policed in modern society, especially in the workplace. For decades, African-American women have been pressured to straighten their hair to avoid racism.
On the talk show, we discussed the film and if our guests think the natural hair movement is gaining acceptance. In this clip, you'll hear Rena Golden, founder and director of the Avenue Black Box Theater and host of The Goddess Hour on WAYO FM. Then you'll hear Casey Jones, a reporter at News 10 NBC. But first, here's Erica Wilson, a producer at News 10 NBC, on if the culture is changing.
I definitely see a change culturally. I mean, ever since, like, in the film, I got to check out the film already. I heard some of the ladies say, like, you know, when YouTube came around, like, it changed a lot of things. Like, women were doing tutorials. Women were talking about the products that they're using. They were talking about the styles that they were wearing. It was just, like, a time for everyone to come together to share what it is that we've been wanting to do and be accepted for forever. So it's definitely changed. In the workplace, I can definitely touch on that. Because I'm behind the scenes, I think that I have the ability and the privilege of looking any way that I want to. I mean, although that sounds kind of crazy, but I will come in with maybe faux locks, like some goddess locks, one, maybe 2 months. And then the next month I'll come in with like some Bantu knots. And people, of course, coworkers, white coworkers would be like, so is this the same hair that you have like in those little knots that you wear out in the fro? Like, is this like, how do you do that? And I'm like, for one, I'm thankful I'm able to do that because for people like Casey and maybe anchors, they don't have the privilege of switching up their looks like how a producer does. So a lot of questions are always asked about how I'm wearing my hair. Like today I have 3 ponytails. This morning I had Bantu knots, honestly. But before I got here, it turned out to be 3 ponytails. So it's a difference.
But Erica, I couldn't help but find myself laughing when you're describing, you know, your white colleagues going, is that the same hair? But I wonder if, does that exhaust you? I mean, or you know, do you kind of just roll with it? How do you feel about that?
Okay, peace and pumpkin spice. But yes, it's very annoying. Mm-hmm. It's very annoying. And so another piece that I saw mentioned in the documentary when one woman was like, you know, like, you have to educate them. That's the only way for them to know. So they can, you let them know and then you stop it right there. But it's been to the point where my hair has been touched. And
yeah, that's way out of bounds.
Exactly. Where I was like, do not touch me. Made an announcement. And almost put my dukes up ready to fight.
many of us see that as those microaggressions, and in some mm-hmm. case macro, like you actually put your hands on me, like on my physical person, which is completely inappropriate.
Yeah.
But even just the microaggressions of constantly having to answer for your hair in the workplace, you know, that's a whole nother thing. Or, you know, the tone of it being different, this constant idea of different and othering, and that being something that is, you know, tends to begin to feel very aggressive toward mm-hmm. you if every day you have to explain something that someone else is considering, or a large majority of your co-workers are considering something other than the norm.
Exactly.
So when Erica brings up Casey and people who are on the air who may have different expectations, your hair is straight today. How do you feel about what's changing and what you'd like to see change?
I would definitely agree that there is a cultural shift. More people are comfortable wearing their natural hair, but we still have a long way to go. Mm. And I would say that because when I do wear my hair straight, and when I wear my hair straight, nobody wants to touch my hair. But then when it's curly, can I touch your hair? You know, it's just the same microaggressions. But bigger than that, just in terms of working as a reporter on air, when they hire us, they want us to keep the same consistent look that, you know, they wanted. So when I came here, I decided to, you know, try it out, wear my hair curly naturally, and it was accepted very much by viewers and by my boss. Everybody was, they liked it, or at least they said they did. And it was a breath of fresh air. But then when you look at the bigger picture, you know, I have industry veterans telling me that you're going to have to change your hair if you want to get a job somewhere else. You have to be more consistent, as some would say, if you want to get a job somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And the consistency piece of it is hard as somebody who wants to wear their natural hair, because who knows what's going to come out? You know, you might do a twist out at night and you decide you want to, you know, style it in a different way. And sometimes that's considered distraction on television, unfortunately. And even when you talk about cultural shifts, just, you know, what was it? A couple years ago, the Army just lifted their ban. The military just lifted their ban on dreadlocks. Mm-hmm. And when I was out in Texas, I found that there were several local school districts, more than at least five school districts that had in their dress code that no afros were allowed, no dreadlocks were allowed. And that's a way of discriminating. Obviously, you're not talking about a white person when you say no afro and no dreads. So it's, like I said, I do see a shift. More people are comfortable wearing it, but we still have so long to go.
Finally this week, a sometimes lighthearted, sometimes serious conversation about aliens. Specifically, we discussed the strange object that came speeding through our solar system last year. Scientists call it Oumuamua, named for the Hawaiian telescope that first spotted it. It's a very fast-moving object, half a mile long, shaped like a cigar, and it sped past the sun, took a look at Earth, and then coasted out of our solar system. And believe it or not, this marks the first time we've ever seen something like this come from outside our own solar system.
So what is it? It's probably an unusual piece of space rock left over after the collapse of a star. But last month, Harvard researchers floated the possibility that Oumuamua is a piece of alien technology sent to spy on us. We brought in physicist Brian Koberline from RIT, who has also studied this thing. In this clip, he begins by responding to the question, what percentage chance do you give Oumuamua for being an alien spacecraft?
Less than 1%.
Less than 1%.
But that being said, I would add the other part of it. And that is, the reason I would say less than 1% is because I'm very cautious in making a claim about something. There are lots of things that this could be. One of them is a probe from another star system. What's interesting about the idea of a probe from another star system is that the idea of using a solar sail and going to another solar system and kind of looping very close to the central star to see if there's anything in kind of the habitable zone, which is exactly what this thing did. When it looped, its closest approach was closer than Mercury, and it swooped out, so it would have gotten a good view of the inner solar system. And we know that it accelerated out of the solar system faster than gravity would have expected. So something was pushing on it beyond gravity. The idea of using a solar cell to go to another star is exactly the type of idea that we would use. If we wanted to go to Vega, or if we wanted to go to Proxima Centauri, one of the top ideas would be to use a solar cell.
Definitely.
Get it some speed.
Yep.
And then when it goes into the other solar system, use a solar cell to go on to the next one.
It sounds like you're talking yourself into this.
I'm not talking myself into it, but that is...
But that's why Harvard scientists can write this paper and not be laughed out of the room, maybe.
Right. Because it's not an entirely unreasonable idea. And we have thought about this, of how do you traverse the light years that it takes to go to another star system. It really is going to take something like a solar cell. It can't be conventional rockets.
All right, so let me actually read from what the Harvard researchers wrote in their paper. They wrote, quote, light sails with similar dimensions have been designed and constructed by our own civilization, including the Icarus, mm-hmm. Icarus project, and the Starshot initiative. The light sail technology might be abundantly used for transportation of cargoes between planets or between stars, end quote. And in the paper, the researchers theorize that the object's high speed and its unusual trajectory could be the result of it being a sail that is no longer operational. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now let's do the less than 1%, but let's say for a moment that it is an alien probe. Would it be more likely to be operational or not operational to you?
Okay. If you're going to grant it the 1% and say it's an alien probe, I'm going to say it's operational.
You're going to say it's operational?
Just because if they're going to come here, they might as well have it designed that way.
Damn right. Good. Good for you. Okay, so now we're going down the alien track. And when it comes to, you know, light sail or solar power, explain mm-hmm. it, like the technology of how that would actually work, how this thing is moving at such a high speed.
So the proposed idea for this would be what we would call a light sail. It's not a solar panel, but really what it is just a very thin, large sheet of reflective material. You think of like mylar sheeting. That's basically what you're talking about, in just in a more advanced way. And the reason it's useful is that when sunlight comes from the sun or any other star, it gives off a lot of light, and that light has a little bit of pressure, not much, but when it reflects off of a surface, it pushes that surface just a little bit. So if you have something that's fairly light and you have a very large light sail, all of that little push of pressure is enough to build up over time to give it some pretty serious speed.
So obviously it's aliens, and that is another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear podcasts. You can hear podcasts? Well, you can hear the podcast.
And aliens.
And aliens. The aliens can hear everything. But you can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. I think I'm going to watch Contact this weekend. Remember that movie?
I do, and I want to know, what is the device that the Oumuamuans use? That's an easy term, isn't it? Oumuamuans. It's aliens. Megan, Evan, thanks for listening. Talk to you on member-supported public radio.